I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The question many people are asking today is, might Senator John Kerry's botched joke, as he calls it, end up causing Democrats to lose elections next week when, for the first time in years, the party is within striking distance of regaining the House and maybe even the Senate? For more on that and other tales from the campaign trail, including some new Wall Street Journal poll numbers, we turn to John Harwood, national political editor for the Journal. Welcome, John.
Thanks for having me.
Well, and I thought we'd start by playing back what the Massachusetts senator told a group of students in California this week, and then what his text was that he planned to say. Let's listen to what he did say.
We're here to talk about education, but I want to say something before that. You know, education, if you make the most of it, you study hard, you do your homework, and you make an effort to be smart, you can do well. If you don't, you get stuck in Iraq.
All right. And according to Kerry's text, the remarks were to have been, do you know where you end up if you don't study, if you aren't smart, if you're intellectually lazy? You end up getting us stuck in a war in Iraq. Just ask President Bush. John Harwood, of course, the right is making mincemeat of this. What are you hearing out in Girardeau?
Well, I think this is something that Claire McCaskill, the Democratic Senate candidate, who I was just with a few moments ago, is sloughing off, saying it was a dumb remark, but it's irrelevant to her campaign, which is how I think ultimately most voters will see it. John Kerry's not on the ballot this year. And in some ways, although this will provide Republicans a rallying cry, a way to rally their base, it also provides an opportunity for some Democrats to push off against John Kerry and the National Democratic Party. Harold Ford in Tennessee has called on Kerry to apologize. Let's him show voters in Tennessee, hey, I'm not just like all the liberal National Democrats.
Does this whole conversation distract, though, from other issues?
It is a distraction from the message that Democrats have wanted to get out. On the other hand, it takes attention to the Iraq War, and the Iraq War is a huge negative for Republican candidates. We've seen that in our Wall Street Journal NBC poll, record high levels of people saying the war was not worth fighting, record high levels saying they're pessimistic about it, and the overwhelming majority of people who don't feel good about the war in Iraq are backing Democratic candidates. So that issue on net is a positive for the Democrats.
Well, it's interesting because we have your poll numbers. President Bush gaining a bit of ground on his handling of the economy. We were questioning that this week with an economic analyst. Why isn't the rise in the Republican Party talking more about what some see as a success story for them? But the polls also show that people aren't listening to news about the economy. They're talking about the war.
Well, you know, there are different economies for different people. People at the upper end of the income spectrum have done very well. But people in the middle and the bottom of the income spectrum are not keeping up in terms of wages. The president's approval ratings, as gas prices have gone down and the market's been booming, have gone up. But it's not what's driving this election.
Well, political pundits say the best-case scenario for Republicans is that they only lose 12 seats in the House and 2 in the Senate, not enough for Democrats to regain control. The best-case scenario for Democrats is said to be that they don't lose any of their seats and win as many as 43 Republican-held seats in the House and 6 in the Senate. Can you make any predictions here, or is it still in a wobbly state?
Well, it's plainly an election in which the optimistic scenarios are more likely to come through for the Democrats than for the Republicans. Most of the strategists that I talk to think the Democrats will gain somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 seats in the House, enough to regain control, maybe a few more than that, and think that in the Senate they'll probably fall short. But some of the key races, Missouri, Virginia, Tennessee, are volatile. They're very close. And so those are still yet to be determined by last-minute developments. President Bush is coming here into Missouri on Friday for Jim Talent, the Republican incumbent.
Well, and if a Democratic senator inserting his foot and perhaps an entire leg into his mouth is not going to upset the balance, what else might we look for? I mean, what could happen in the next few days that might tip the balance a little?
You know, we have seen opinion so stable, that is at the national level, during the course of the year, people thinking the country's in the wrong direction, not feeling good about Iraq, not feeling good about President Bush. I really don't think, Robin, there's an October surprise. Actually, we're in November now. I don't think there's a November surprise either that's going to fundamentally change the national dynamic. It's really about execution at individual state campaigns, and some of the last-minute gambits on either side, those are the critical variables at the end.
John Harwood, national political editor for The Wall Street Journal and chief Washington correspondent for CNBC. John, thanks as always.
Hey, it's my pleasure.
And by the way, I think I neglected to say that John is in Missouri. Well, now we'd like to check in Britain, because while Americans have been consumed with politics and the war in Iraq, Britain has been wrestling with the issue of Muslim immigration, a topic that came to a head recently in a controversy over the niqab, the face covering veil that some Muslim women wear. You remember Cabinet Minister Jack Straw asked Muslim women visiting his office if they would mind removing it because, he said, the veil hampers the kind of informal communication that binds communities. Well, Prime Minister Tony Blair then entered the fray by saying that the full veil is a mark of separation that makes others uncomfortable. In other words, a symbol of self-segregation. But many moderate Muslims say the alienation of the Muslim community is a result of failed British policy. Well, how's that debate going? To find out, we're joined from a studio in London by veteran British journalist and anchor of Channel 4 News, John Snow, who's made a documentary on this subject. Welcome, John.
Thank you, Robin.
And Humaira Khan, a social activist and founder of Q Muslim News. Humaira, welcome to you as well.
Hello.
And we want to start with you. What is going on now with Britain and the veil controversy? You know, sort of take the temperature for us. Has it died down a little bit?
I think really that the veil itself is not the issue people are concerned about so much. I think there's so many other hidden subjects that people are sort of using this as a tool, basically.
So in other words, there was one story of a teacher, for instance, who interviewed for the job without the veil and then went to work in the full face covering. And there was a real concern that both children, as we heard it, both children couldn't understand her or hear her, or that they were just frightened, didn't know what was behind the veil.
In Britain, we have negotiated over the decades the possibility that Muslim women with a whole variety of ways of wearing their veils are integrated in mainstream society. Certainly in London, you can find dustbin sweepers, I've seen it myself, taxi drivers, bank clerks, business women, whole range of people, women, who do wear it. And I think this Jack Straw's comments has really detracted from what really has been the phenomenal achievement in this country with actually being open to the different kind of dress that people wear, really.
Well, in fact, there are other things going on, as you know, would be obvious, but also, as John Snow, you found in both a recent survey and your research to try to get behind the survey. You traveled around Britain. Tell us, first of all, what the results of the survey were, what jumped out at you, and then what you tried to find.
Well, I think the things that jumped out were the sense of people in the Muslim community believing that quite a lot of what we're told is simply not true. So, for example, you take 9/11, I think 56% of Muslims questioned believed that there was an American hand, possibly an Israeli hand, at work in the events of 9/11.
Still they believe that.
There is a lot of mistrust about the way in which things are portrayed.
Well, you also wrote an article, and the headline jumped out at us. It seemed as if another overarching finding of the survey was that pretty much Muslim integration had come to a halt because the younger generation of Muslims, the children of parents who had been immigrants, perhaps children who had been born in Britain, much more conservative than their parents?
Well, we certainly found that religious devotion was stronger amongst the children of first-generation immigrants. I think this is not an unnatural finding. I mean, you have new immigrants arriving in Britain who desperately want to make their way in the new community and to some extent subjugate their culture and their traditions in order to try to find their place economically.
To assimilate.
Yeah. And then, of course, having done so, the children begin to have much greater freedom to decide what they want to do. And many of them have returned to their cultural, traditional, religious roots.
But
are more radical than their parents in that regard.
But you say that might be usual. In the United States, we would find that unusual. Humaira, I wanted to ask you to weigh in on that, because here in the U.S., it's the more conservative immigrant parents who are bemoaning the fact that their, you know, American-born children become more liberal. First of all, do you agree with that finding of the survey?
Well, I mean, I think most probably I agree with the finding of the surveys, that most probably that is a fair, you know, reflection. But I think you can't fully compare America and Britain because they're different migration patterns, different types of people. I think if you understand the sort of barriers that Muslims have faced institutionally, that has actually shaped their sort of stepping back from the establishment because they don't feel understood and they don't feel welcome.
So you're one who is saying that the policies of the British government have failed these young people and perhaps forced them into self-segregation.
I don't see self-segregation in the negative way that you're implying in your question. I think segregation by definition doesn't mean it's a bad thing. That means Middle England, which is predominantly white, which is segregated, you could argue, culturally, racially, religiously, is then a bad thing. So it doesn't make it a bad thing. It means it's people's attitudes that perhaps we have to think about. And I think if people have stepped away from integrating because of barriers, that is more concerning than the fact that you have communities where you have large groups of people from a single cultural religious group.
There's also a problem here, Humaira, and that is that there is no perfect model of immigration. And I don't like to be compared with the United States, for example. The United States is a totally different order. And I'm not absolutely certain that you'd be right in saying that Muslim immigrants in the United States are less radical than their parents.
I find it fascinating that you are touching on these issues of the difference between the British Muslim community and the American, because in fact we're going to be hearing from a leading American Muslim next week, and she's told us exactly what you're saying, that one of the reasons that while there are definitely tensions in the U.S., as we all know, there aren't as many tensions, and the tensions are different because many American Muslims are, first of all, converts. They might be African-American, or they might be from different communities. But they buy into, and these are her words, they buy into the American dream. Is what I'm hearing you say, Humaira, that there isn't that sense of either being welcomed into or buying into some sort of British dream, if you will?
I'm somebody who came to Britain in 1961 at the age of one, so I know, I've lived through this. And our parents at that time didn't come here dysfunctional and hating anybody. But what I would argue is it's the discrimination in some spheres, not across the board, that Muslims have faced, the lack of understanding, that has made people feel defensive and reactionary.
Actually, I don't see a terrible danger in what's going on at the moment. I think people are feeling uncomfortable because it's new, it's different. But I think what's actually happening is that our society is diversifying in an extremely exciting kind of a way. But the top level of it, if you like, the administrative and kind of role modelling and the rest of it, the trickle down is still from the white indigenous Britain. And I think the next generation, we're going to see a much more multicultural top, and we won't have so many problems at the bottom.
Where
we have a problem, Robin, is that we've got politicians messing about with it who want to get up and scream about the veil instead of thinking about the rather more crucial issues like faith schools. But America has had the sense to have a constitution which doesn't agree with faith schools, even though, of course, they're seeping in at every level.
Well, I just wanted to jump in to say we need to take a break. That's veteran British journalist and anchor of Channel 4 News, John Snow. We're also speaking with Humaira Khan, social activist and founder of Q Muslim News. They will both be back after the break. We want to hear their view of the effect of the war on terrorism on British Muslims. Much more coming up. Stay with us here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're getting an update on the debate over Muslim immigration in Britain. Our guests are British journalist John Snow, who anchors Channel 4 News, and Humaira Khan, social activist and founder of Q Muslim News. Just before the break, we were hearing about a recent survey that showed that children of Muslim immigrants in the UK are more devout, more conservative than their parents. And Humaira, just last month, the British Home Secretary, John Reid, said that Muslim families need to watch out and make sure their children don't get involved in radical Islam. He said, I'm going to quote here from him, "There's no nice way of saying this. Fanatics are looking to groom and brainwash your children, including your children, for suicide bombings, grooming themselves to murder others," he went on. So, Humaira, how is the Muslim community reacting to that assumption, or, on the other hand, maybe protecting themselves from that reality?
Well, just even hearing you quote that puts a massive pain in my heart just hearing it. And of course, that's how we generally feel. We feel really pained, misunderstood, voiceless, not able to really articulate adequately what we really want to say, and sort of really suffering from a lack of constructive leadership. The stuff that's coming out from the government, I believe, is not really that much to do with the Muslim community. It's a debate and conflict within themselves as a government. And I think they are talking to themselves about their own idiosyncrasies and their issues and their conflicts, possibly rooted in the different positions that people have about the Iraq war. And it's sort of spilling out and using us as scapegoats.
But we've even heard young Muslim boys talk about this, that they feel they're preyed upon in schools in London because they're converts or because they might seem vulnerable to being a future radical. You know, is there such polarization that it's hard to even address this when it comes from a Muslim?
You've got to understand this in the context of the Race Relations Act in Britain. Britain, you know, when you had a large-scale migration in the 70s, 50s, whatever, there was tension, there was riots, there was a lot of discrimination. We had the Race Relations Act and we had all the sort of initiatives that came. The race relations industry was always very vehemently left-wing, secular, and could not possibly fathom the idea that there's such a thing as faith-based communities. If the race relations had acknowledged that there were communities, minority communities who saw themselves differently and their needs came from that, and we had legislation or processes of engagement, which was constructively done through government processes, I don't believe we would be quite in the situation that we're in. And 5 years ago, there was absolutely no research hardly done on the Muslim community. We have library falls now. But the issue is, it's not about the reports and the research. They can dichotomize us till the cows come home. The issue is about implementation. How do you constructively implement change institutionally where Muslims are feeling alienated? And the social alienation young people feel on the ground is different from what they possibly feel about foreign policy, right?
Well, and that's one of the biggest things we found in our survey, is that alienation is driven by foreign policy. I mean, there is no war in which Britain is involved in which Britain is not killing Muslims. It's a most unfortunate fact, but there it is. It has been involved in Afghanistan and remains so, is involved in Iraq, has been involved in other wars, and is seen by the Muslim community to be on the wrong side of the Middle East equation as well. And these definitely play, as does the neglect of Chechnya, for example. Now, to hear us talking about foreign policy when we're trying to talk about intimate relations within a British community may sound odd. But you see, I think this is where the great elephant in the room that we don't see, don't want to talk about, but is ever present. Well, and that is the war on terror. The war on terror has been a catastrophe for communities in Britain, because it has over-egged the pudding. Yeah. It has allowed politicians to run riot with paranoia, with allegation, with suspicion, with claims that people are doing this, that and the other. At the end of the day, the evidence, the factual, tangible evidence, is very small.
But John Snow, I do have to jump in. I mean, the London train bombers, some of them were trained in training camps. There are cells, there have been cells
And every one of them, in any testimony that was left behind by them, either in video or in print, spoke of foreign policy. This was the driver. The driver was Chechnya, was Afghanistan, was Kashmir, was Iraq, upon which Britain is seen by the Muslim community as being woefully in the wrong court.
That's Channel 4 News anchor John Snow speaking to us from Britain. We're also speaking with Humaira Khan, founder of Q Muslim News. And John, I just want to, one quick thing that also jumped up out at us from your reporting on your research into the Muslim immigration issue, is that you write at the end, I came into contact with Muslims I've never met before. I found them to be a very dynamic community. It strikes me that that's something that you discovered as well, that perhaps there just needs to be a way for people to meet people that they've never met before.
In a way, that exactly takes me back to the point I was making about the speed with which all this has happened and the fact that the higher orders in the social system don't really come into contact with Muslims. You know, there's a question in the air here. How many Muslims have you had to dinner? You know, well, I mean, I've had the good fortune to do my broadcast with a Muslim cohort, and she's been to dinner at my place. But I genuinely could not. I could count on one hand the number of Muslims I've ever had.
I'd invite
to
you
dinner.
For dinner,
Humaira. It's a deal. It's a date. But I mean, seriously, that is a reality. It won't be a reality, I think. You know, come the next generation, as long as we hold our nerve and don't go mad, sort of talking about the veil, for example, which affects a tiny proportion of the Muslim women. We have 800,000 Muslim women in Britain, and I think, Humaira, we're talking about 10,000 to 20,000 women who actually wear the veil.
I'm going to ask you to continue this over dinner.
We will.
Humaira
Well,
Khan.
Robin, take a cheap flight. Come over and talk about it. Let's spend some carbon emissions and get talking.
And get talking. Veteran British journalist and anchor of Channel 4 News, John Snow. Humaira Khan, social activist, founder of Q Muslim News. Thank you both so much for speaking with us today.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you, Robin.
And as we mentioned, just want to note again, next week on Here and Now, we're going to speak to Dr. Ingrid Mattson, the first woman, the first convert to lead the Islamic Society of North America. And it's interesting, she's been saying that she'd advise Muslim women not to wear the full face veil because it has such a different meaning in the U.S. than it does in their home countries. It's sort of a when in Rome approach that she takes on that topic, at least. We'll hear more from her next week. Well, what do you think? As always, we'd love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. letters@here-now.org, or give a call and leave a message, 617-358-0397, 617-358-0397. Please include your full name, your phone number, and your town. Well, stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. One night this week, I headed over to Tower Records in Harvard Square here in Massachusetts. Outside, I found a classical music fan clutching his bag of Tower's Going Out of Business Sale CDs.
Yeah, I'm really sad that they're gone. I love looking at them. I love looking at the CDs. I love talking to people about them. I love the fact that you could talk to somebody in the store who knows something about it.
In Vivaldi's day, he was not the big name.
It's the lament of classic music fans in particular. Since the California-based chain Tower Records filed for bankruptcy and was sold to a liquidation company last month, classical music lovers have been mourning the loss of one of the last great places to mingle. Inside Tower's enclosed classic music sanctum, we shoppers met a violinist who recommended a recently discovered Vivaldi piece thought to have been written by Galuppi.
How do you spell it?
He's pretty obscure. G-A-L-P-I?
P-I.
I think there might be two P's. It's a little like Salieri was, you know.
Right.
If you'll excuse me, I'm going to reach across the bin here and say, then this kind of a conversation, you asking him what he was recommending.
It's not going to happen online. It's not going to happen online. Because someone can tell you, I heard this, it's fabulous. Or, I've heard it, it stinks.
Yep.
Yeah. And you're not going to find the educated and well-informed staff people online either. Yeah, and that's why we need stores.
My visit to Tower Records here in Harvard Square. Well, we turn now to Anthony Tomasini, chief music critic at the New York Times, who recently wrote his own mournful goodbye to Tower's classic music rooms. Anthony, I understand your local store is near Lincoln Center. Is the scene there the same as it was in Harvard Square?
Yeah, there are a couple stores here, but the one that has become sort of legendary is the one right next to Lincoln Center. It's a very sad place these days.
Describe the scene for us.
Well, it's, you know, off on the second floor, and you go through glass doors, and it's kind of room unto itself, and then the opera, vocal music room, is even further back, even more isolated.
Really?
And it's really been a gathering place for music lovers, record collectors, for people just getting into music, and, you know, you'll bump into Ruth Ann Swenson there, or artists, you know, from the Met, or Juilliard students.
Or people bump into you, Anthony Tomasini. You've given people advice, right?
Yes, I have, but I have a kind of well-knownness that is mostly anonymous. Mm-hmm. But I did, just the other day, I was going in there to sort of case the joint, to write my sad column, and there was this forlorn elderly couple trying to find a Ring recording, and I did wind up helping them and giving them some advice.
Well,
but that happens all the time.
Yeah.
These record stores have been places where people help each other, and you just bump into fellow travelers and hear things playing and just ask questions, you know, of the managers, and it's a real, real loss.
Well, and it's not just Tower Records. You mentioned in your column mourning the loss of Tower Records. The Harvard Coop that used to be here in Cambridge and in Harvard Square, at least in the form that you're talking about, where there was a woman you called the Tsarina of classical music.
Yes.
I remember her too, Pamela
Dalal. Pamela Dalal, yeah. She sold more records when she was there, because people would come in and they'd be confused. She said, gee, Mozart's Requiem, and she'd just run to a corner and take something and put it in their hands. This is what you want.
Right.
She was there during the real burst of CDs. she was almost like providing therapy for people during this transition, that we're going to be okay. This is all going, you know, this, you watch, it's going on balance, it's going to be, we're going to be better off. But it was just like with bookstores, it didn't matter whether you agreed with them. I remember Pam having a little bit more regard for Christopher Hogwood and those recordings of the Academy of Ancient Instruments than I did, but that's fine. That was part of the fun of it, and getting into little discussions or tiffs about it was like part of the fun. But I think we don't have those kind of bookstores are disappearing too. The paradox about the loss of Tower Records is that it's a chain. You know, when it first showed up, it was like the big bully, you know, and was pushing out little stores that I remember in New York, like the Record Hunter and Discophile. But now, over years, it's come. It's the last vestige we have of the small record shop. You watch when the internet completely takes over and Barnes & Noble bites the dust, we'll probably be seeing that as the final end of the bookstore.
And I heard people this week, Anthony, saying that they don't think that there's going to be anywhere in America where they can walk into a store and buy classical music. Do you think that's true?
I think places will crop up. There are still places in New York like J&R, Sound World, but you're right that Tower was far from perfect, and it made its fame by promising to have everything, you know, in stock. And of course, that's for years and years, that's not been true. But it had a pretty good collection, especially that Lincoln Center store. You could really find things there. And in the column I wrote recently, I said, you know, if the Met Opera was smart, they would take their small collection and build it into something really extensive, at least an opera. They could be the sort of go-to place for opera.
Right.
Even the Juilliard bookstore could take advantage and fill in the void.
And what about some of the other ways that other music lovers and other genres are buying their music? What about Amazon.com or downloading?
Well, there it is. It's, you know, the future is here, and that's what's going to happen. And especially for some smaller labels and independent companies, I mean, the internet provides a way to get their CDs out, you know, to reach people. And the real advocates of the online world say that, well, that conversation that you had in front of the shelves of Wagner operas is still going to happen, but it's going to happen online. I know that's the idea. I maybe it's just, it dates me, but it's just hard for me to feel that way about it.
The other thing I worry about is that you're suddenly going to see on Amazon.com, you know, Fred's greatest classical hits as seen on late night TV, and you won't know, you know, who, you know, is some schlocky version of, you know, Mahler.
Yeah, there are sites that I'm sure I don't even know about, and I probably should know about, but that, you know, the big ones don't offer a lot of guidance. And downloading, yes, you know, there it is. It's coming, and I don't know what it will all mean.
Well, it certainly might mean a little more time. I'm picturing that older couple that you met hours later downloading the Ring trilogy.
Yeah, I know.
Meanwhile, back at my visit to Tower Records, Harvard Square, a perfect example of what a store offers on the Classic Music Room sound system.
Excuse me, do you know what this is? I feel I heard Masterworks.
Mahler's Second Symphony.
Oh, is that what it is? It's beautiful.
It's unbelievable, isn't it?
Oh, boy. And, you know, and I wouldn't be reminded of this.
Yeah, this is a great, great piece.
If I weren't standing here. Well, now I got to go see if I can find this.
Meanwhile, Anthony Tomasini, the violinist I bumped into at Tower Records in Harvard Square, recommended an Abbado Mahler Symphony No. 2. Okay, choice?
Oh, yes, he's wonderful. I mean, Mahler recordings, you get into fights with people, but Abbado is maybe the most universally respected conductor around right now. So, yes, he's wonderful.
So, see?
Yeah.
I got good advice in the near the empty bins at Tower.
Yeah.
Anthony, thanks so much.
Sure. Take care.
Anthony Tomasini, chief music critic at the New York Times, and this is my new Mahler CD. You're listening to Hear Now. Remember the story from a few years back? If you type miserable failure into a Google search box, the first entry will be President Bush's official website. It was true. It surfaced in December 2003 and spread like wildfire over the Internet. Well, typing miserable failure today brings President Bush's site up as number 2 on the index, followed now, by the way, by Jimmy Carter's website. But the first entry, a Google disclaimer saying Google search results have nothing to do with politics. They are influenced by Google bombing, planting multiple references and links in order to skew the ranking of results generated by Google searches. Google bombs, dropped mostly by left-leaning bloggers, they flood the Google engine with negative articles about Republican candidates. Chris Bowers is a contributor at MyDD.com. It stands for My Direct Democracy. He says this tactic has put negative articles about GOP candidates in front of about 5,000 viewers a day, and he's here with more. Chris, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, last week you posted instructions for your readers on how to plant such a Google bomb and included a list of about 50 of the politicians you'd like to target. Who's at the top of your list?
There was no one really at the top of the list because this is such a I was trying to do a wide-ranging campaign that with 50 Republicans, there was no one in particular. If I had to pick one, maybe George Allen of Virginia.
Well, I also see Christopher Shays of Connecticut, Vernon Buchanan of Florida. Let's see who else is on your list. Dennis Hastert, Illinois.
Yes.
What, do you think this is fair?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, search engine optimization is a tactic that smart campaigns have been using for 2 or 3 years now. The only thing that's particularly breaking about what I did is that I brought it out into the open and made the process more transparent and visible to a wider range of people. Right. If you don't use search engine optimization in terms of both purchasing search ads and trying to optimize things through techniques such as Google bombing, you're behind the times in political campaigns.
Well, we absolutely understand that marketers do this. And how do you do it again? You flood with so many of a certain kind of article that it rises to the top?
Yes. It's through a technique called an embedded hyperlink, where if there's a link on someone's name and enough of those links go to the same site, then that site will go up in the search engine rankings.
Hmm. Well, let's do some searching to see how it works. I've got my computer set up here. Kerry Healy is the Republican lieutenant governor here in Massachusetts running for governor against Deval Patrick. Let's see. I'm Googling. And she comes up... There are 5 results that are, her website, Kerry Healy for Massachusetts governor, Kerry Healy, a biography, and then, look at that, Kerry Healy out of touch. It's, I think, the 6th article. It's a negative article about her. And you mentioned George Allen's campaign. When you Google George Allen, his race problems come up 6th on the list of items. Marilyn Musgrave from California comes up with the 10 worst congressmen list, probably something her campaign would not like to see near the top there. How do you know when you're successful and when this is just a natural flow of articles?
Well, there are certain techniques you can use, and we employ some of those. And also, it was a campaign that enough people found interesting when I posted on it, that we had enough people participating in it that was able to work. And we're also monitoring the Google bomb every day to see how well it works for every campaign. And if there are campaigns where it isn't working, maybe we can just sort of drop those. Or if there's campaigns where it isn't working, we can come up with new articles in the Google bomb.
And we should add, these are legitimate negative articles about these candidates. Yeah. You're not making them up. And just one last question, Chris. The Republicans are known for their incredibly well-oiled campaign machine. And yet it seems as if it's the Republican candidates who are being mostly targeted with these Google bombs. Why is that? Because you'd think they would look at this idea and maybe get it going on their side of the aisle.
I think sometimes when you're successful in elections, as Republicans have been over the past 10 or 12 years, you sometimes fail to innovate. And that's something we're seeing from the Democratic side of the aisle in the progressive movement, where we are using new and innovative campaign tactics to try and swing the country back in our direction.
Well, Chris Bowers, by the way, we Googled your name, and the first entry that came up was suppliers of specialist fruit plants. Vast right-wing conspiracy, perhaps.
Maybe I'm not doing well enough in my own personal search engine optimization.
Chris Bowers, a contributor at MyDD.com. That's My Direct Democracy. Chris, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Though he had a cult success with Da Ali G show on HBO, American audiences may have first become aware of British comic Sacha Baron Cohen with his hilarious performance as Jean Girard, the gay Formula One race driver who's Will Ferrell's antagonist in last summer's NASCAR comedy Talladega Nights, The Ballad of Ricky Bobby.
I give you one option, Monsieur Bobby. As a sign of humility, if you kiss me on the lips now, I will return to Paris and you will never see me again in NASCAR.
The answer is never. Do you hear me? Never, ever!
Well, yes or no?
That's sick.
Well, if you hadn't heard of Sacha Baron Cohen, his latest movie is changing that. Borat, Cultural Learnings of America for Make Benefit Glorious Nation of Kazakhstan, opens on Friday. In it, Sacha Baron Cohen completely immerses himself in the character of Borat, an anti-Semitic, boorish, lusty, and yet at the same time clueless television reporter purportedly from the nation of Kazakhstan, whose aim is to make a documentary about America. In the opening scene, Borat introduces us to the village he comes from.
Yetchimash! My name is Borat. I like you. Is this my horse? Answer, please. He is my neighbor, Nursultan Tulyakbai. He is painting my... I get a window from a glass, he must get a window from a glass. I get a step, he must get a step. I get a cloak radio, he cannot afford. Great success.
Through various encounters, some hysterical, some really uncomfortable to watch, some both, Sacha Baron Cohen shines a spotlight on American culture. His portrayal of Kazakhstan has raised hackles from that country. They've even taken out ads defending themselves in the New York Times. Well, how about us look at America? Here to talk more about Borat, the film, and the actor Sacha Baron Cohen, Here Now's pop culture critic Renee Graham. Renee, he is a phenomenon.
He is. He's been really big in his native England for a long time with the Ali G show. But I don't think people really recognize this guy until he did Talladega Nights.
Let's talk more about the show, just because some people may recognize. I mean, he talked as Ali G, this sort of, you know, hairy-chested...
You know, rapper wannabe.
Rapper wannabe. He got top American officials to come on his purported talk show.
He talked to Ralph Nader. He talked to C. Everett Koop. Talked to Kissinger, and he talked to Newt Gingrich.
Let's listen to a clip.
Do you think a woman will ever be president?
Absolutely.
Ain't there a problem that if there is a woman president, they're going to spend all their time on facials, shopping, and getting new shoes?
I think if you said that to most women who could be president, you'd be surprised how tough they are.
But ain't you worried that the old cabinet would be like Brad Pitt on Defense and George Clooney on Elf, you know, because him from ER... You know, and he's just got, like, all these other good-looking geezers and King Kong in the background.
I don't know how he did it, how he continued to get these people on the show.
Part of his appeal was trying to bait people into saying something offensive. And he doesn't know. Newt Gingrich is too savvy. He doesn't go for it. But often people really did. That happens a lot in the Borat movie.
Right. Borat is one of the characters that was on the original TV show, Da Ali G Show. There was Ali G, Bruno, an Austrian fashion reporter, and Borat, who now, you know, as we say, has his own movie. Now, people who have tried to interview him, he doesn't break out of this character of Borat.
It's almost as if publicly Sacha Baron Cohen doesn't exist. All the press he's been doing for this movie, he's been doing as Borat. He does not break character. And there's something to that. He's so deeply immersed in the role that it's easy to see why some people who he talks to think he's a real person.
Tell us a little bit about the movie itself. Borat begins his journey in New York, goes to California in search of his ideal love, former Baywatch star Pamela Anderson.
Well, what's interesting in this character and the way this is presented is that Kazakhstan is a real place. Sacha Baron Cohen could have decided to make up a country, but there's a real audacity in using a real place. And as he presents it, his village is sort of happily populated by rapists and prostitutes, including his sister, with whom he has a disturbingly close relationship, and various other sexual deviants. It's authentic in that this country exists, but since people know nothing about it, it's a clean slate, so he could make the nation into whatever he wanted to be. And needless to say, officials in this country are rather upset about that.
And in making the movie itself, weren't some of the people that he encountered not in on this, whatever the joke is?
Most of the people he encountered aren't in on the joke. I mean, he's got a camera because he lets them know he's making a documentary, but they assume this is something that's going to be shown in his home country that would never be seen here.
So wait a second. Are you saying that Borat, the movie, is really kind of a documentary? In other words, are these actors that he's meeting along the way?
No, for the most part, he's not meeting actors. He's just meeting regular folks across America, gun dealers, car salesmen, and the clip we'll hear next, he's driving around in this old ice cream truck, and he's lost, and he finds himself in the hood, and he stops to talk to some brothers at the projects.
I need a direction to California, please.
Wait, man, who you with?
You look like Michael Jackson, Beat It.
Man, you better get so old.
I like you peoples.
Yeah.
Can you teach me how to dress? How can I be like you?
Well, first of all, you need to loosen up their belt, let them jeans down.
Like this?
Yeah. But don't show your huggies, though, man.
What kind of music you listen to?
I like very much a Corky Buchek. You know Corky Buchek? Bing, bang, bing, bang, bing, bing,
I mean, you know, you can't script that, you know. And for him to go into the projects at night, you know, playing this naive character. And the characters who are tough, well, not our characters at all, the people he encounters in this instance are sort of endearing, but they also are who they are. They don't really step out of line, but in other instances, there's an example, he goes into a gun store and he says, well, you know, because the character is supposed to be very anti-Semitic, you know, what kind of gun should I get to kill Jews? And without missing the beat, the gun owner says, a 9mm.
Yeah.
But, you know, at the same time, you know, I don't want to get into some big sociological examination of the movie. Ultimately, you're laughing at a lot of poop jokes.
Well, but let's just dial back to what you just said. The character is anti-Semitic.
Mm-hmm.
Sacha Baron Cohen, isn't he Jewish?
He is Jewish.
What's he doing? What's he trying to say?
You know, prejudice exists. We all know it exists. Anti-Semitism is out there, as is racism. There's something to getting people to admit it. Everyone on the surface tries to be upfront and self-righteous and, oh, I don't hate anyone. But sometimes you get people at an unsuspecting moment and they'll say what they really think. It happens again later in the movie where he ends up on a Winnebago with a bunch of South Carolina frat boys who start to speak very wistfully about the fact that slavery no longer exists.
How did he get these people to, you know, sign away the rights to be in the film? I mean, it's one thing to get them to, you know, to just open up on camera, but then now they're in a movie.
Well, that's a tricky thing. It seems in some of the things I've read about the making of the film that everyone signed a release, but I don't think they knew exactly what they were signing. It may have just said something vague, and in some cases, people probably didn't bother reading it at all.
Yeah. Well, and now they're going to be on the big screen opening this weekend, talking about the new film Borat, Cultural Learnings of America for Make Benefit, Glorious Nation of Kazakhstan, starring Sacha Baron Cohen. So, Renee Graham, do you recommend it?
It's a movie that has incest, animal cruelty, masturbation. It's the most offensive film I've ever seen, and also one of the funniest. Recommending it is something else entirely. I'm not quite sure how to recommend the movie, because I know some people who will be so deeply offended. You know, if I recommend this to friends of mine, they might not ever speak to me again. It's not for everyone. It's really like the cool kids movie. Not to say that you're cool if you go see it, but it's like one big in-joke. Either you get it or you don't. It really is out there on the edge. But I think that's what I like about it. I love the fearlessness of what Sacha Baron Cohen does in this movie.
That's here now, pop culture critic Renee Graham. Ticket buyer beware, I guess. Renee, thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin.
And this quick note, ticket buyers will have fewer places to see Borat this weekend than expected. 20th Century Fox, the studio behind the film, confirmed that it will cut the number of theaters it was planning to show the movie in by more than half because surveys showed that moviegoers still aren't aware of Borat. They don't know that character and they don't get it. But don't tell that to Sacha Baron Cohen. There's also a bidding war on his next film, which will feature another of his characters, Bruno, the gay fashion reporter from the Dali G show. Universal so far is topping that bidding at $42 million. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.